is 40ANM N5, a download of 40ANM LLC. Recorded at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, January 13th, 2014. Happy New Year to all of you. I'm Chris Bohm, and I'm delighted to be back with you for your Monday morning with this, our weekly selection of tech sector-related global news and policy highlights from the past few weeks. Coming up, notes from several news outlets on last week's Consumer Electronics Show. Innovations aplenty, as well as some things to challenge us. Verizon talks about its converged health management platform with the Gray Sheet. AT&T announces a scheme to let websites and app makers pay for your mobile bandwidth. And the latest on NSA surveillance revelations, including a U.S. District Court opinion, quantum computing, and indications from President Obama that he may decide to announce actions later this month. The U.S. Senate's Commerce Committee takes up data brokerage issues in December, while the Senate Banking Committee may address customer recourse issues in January in the wake of the Target data breach. What is consent? Can it evolve, or should we even still be thinking about it? The discussion of the moment among many international privacy professionals. EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding declares that it's full speed ahead for a vote on the draft EU General Data Protection Regulation. Sky updates its new porn filters after an inadvertent block of a news site in the UK, and two news items of note. Executive orders issued in the US on gun background checks, and Janet Yellen is confirmed as the next leader of the Federal Reserve. First up this week, let's cover something positive, maybe even a little innovative, or at least thought-provoking. The past week has been the week of the Consumer Electronics Show 2014 in Las Vegas, at which the major theme this year seems to have been connected everything. If you like Product X, then throw a little internet on it, and so on. For instance, the BBC reported on Samsung's announcement of a system to link together a household's various gadgets, appliances, and utility controls. One way that Samsung's smart home service was profiled could see it to use to turn off a home's lights and TV if the owner were simply to say, going out, into a device. Although Samsung expects to initially launch the service to link its own products, the plan is to support third-party devices in time. The question raised in the BBC article is, of course, why would other manufacturers want to tailor their devices for use with the platform? Other companies, including Archos and LG, were expected to demo similar strategies at CES, but as pointed out in the BBC piece, brand loyalty across appliance categories isn't always strong. In other words, if you buy one company's fridge, you're not often predisposed to buy their TV, so the brand-neutral interoperability of any platform would seem to be the smart play over the long term. Other products debuted at CES highlighted the increasing integration of biometrics data. As pointed out by the Washington Post, the commercial use of biometrics comes as the FBI and other law enforcement agencies ramp up their own collection of biometrics, such as fingerprints and facial and voice data. But tablets that measure pupil dilation to determine whether you're in the mood for a comedy or a drama? The race to create more tailored customer experiences and perhaps profit from hyper-targeted ads is also testing new boundaries for privacy. In part, the advances are being brought on by an abundance of cheap sensors and increasing advances in computing technology and speed. For instance, the Washington Post highlighted that Interaxon had developed a headband that could purportedly tell whether a wearer is either bored with the task or losing concentration. Other items, such as Microsoft's stress detection bras and mood-sensing earbuds, are still in development, reportedly. Whereas some of these applications may appear gimmicky, according to Heidi Shea of Forrester Research, who commented on the Washington Post piece, other uses of related technology are front and center already, particularly in the area of security. Fingerprint, palm print and iris scanning, voice recognition software to replace passwords are just a few of the biometrics getting play, both in the marketplace and in new devices showcased at CES. As reported by the Post, Fast Identity Online, or FIDO, an alliance of technology firms that includes Google, Lenovo, and BlackBerry, were expected to announce new tech standards last week for use in biometrics and security. And beyond security, eye scanning may also be taken up for its behavioral data with utility for advertising. One tool highlighted in the Post piece would read pupil dilations to judge whether the user is aroused or if the gaze indicates ignoring banner ads, for instance. When combined with other data, the utility of certain biometrics for advertising and for gauging customer preferences is certain. But whether the application is merely gimmicky today or of vital utility to a consumer, a key factor in assessing these tools for privacy purposes will be how the data is used. What are the implications being drawn from user behavior, and how are these assessments being used to passively narrow user choices or environments? For certain, the data collection itself can be an issue, and particularly if it's misused, including highly sensitive health or identity-related information. Would an employer use an attentiveness-gauging headband, for instance, to measure employee productivity in a highly competitive but otherwise menial task environment? At the same time that we shudder to think that this could possibly be used this way, the realist must acknowledge that someone would probably try. All of us have experienced RASPA, for instance, a term which stands for Random Armchair Statistical and Psychological Assessment. Now, RASPA is what happens when we are moved by a sad story or a quote and post it to social media. And some friends or colleagues, when they see us next, as a result of the posting, presume that we are depressed or have fallen on hard times, when the posting, though it may be the only we've made, is barely relevant to the rest of our daily lives. Now, if we're lucky, RASPA is merely an occasional annoyance, and sometimes maybe even a humorous one, much like the games of nosy neighbors that have gone on in small towns for centuries. But when an HR hiring rep engages in RASPA, perhaps in review of the same posting, the mere annoyance can have lasting economic impact. Imagine then that such poor analytical behavior as RASPA is deployed with a spread of biometrics data. Another set of devices profiled at CES, though not as impactful from a privacy perspective, are just as technologically compelling. Braille, which has facilitated reading among the blind for nearly 200 years, has been enabled in refreshable Braille displays for several decades. But what you may not know is that refreshable Braille displays can be connected to a smartphone or a Kindle to enable the blind and physically handicapped to read Braille e-books and audiobooks. As detailed in a piece by National Public Radio on January 6th, refreshable displays have cells made up of 6 dots, the dots used in Braille, and each dot in a cell can be raised or lowered to indicate different letters. The difficulty, though, is that these displays remain incredibly expensive, at least $1,500 for a small version of a refreshable display, to $3,000 to $4,000 for a larger display. Verizon, another company always present at CES, sat down with the healthcare industry trade paper, The Gray Sheet, in late December, with Verizon's director for mHealth, Julie Kling, helping to profile converged health management. CHM had in October cleared FDA's 510K processes as a Class 2 device, permitting it to be legally marketed. CHM is a monitoring platform that allows biometric data like blood glucose, blood sugar, blood pressure, weight scale, or pulse oximeter to go into the platform. The patient can see how they are doing on these scales over time, and their clinician can review the data as well. The difference with CHM, according to Ms. Kling, is that Verizon has taken a next step with the platform, enabling patient data to be accessed and displayed in a way that's most useful to the patient and their clinician. Ultimately, the platform is, to Verizon, more about patient engagement on the information taken up by the platform and its relevance than the take-up of the information itself. A clinician can use the platform to see across a care set who is participating and who is following through on their care plan, for instance. To verify that the platform's use and display of the information works for patients and their providers, the company began clinical trials, with one launching in December. The aim will be to show both what's working and what's not working, so that the display of the information and patient engagement is optimal for the user. As for the market, Verizon expects that there will be those who are early adopters, perhaps 5 to 10% of the industry, who will test out their model because they believe in the technology without proof. And as Ms. Kling told the Gray Sheet, there is always a bell curve, with perhaps 80% who will wait for various lengths of time. These users always have other things on their minds first, not the early adoption of technology. But as we prove out the converged health management platform, she believes they will come. And in mobile innovation news this past month, on January 5th, AT&T announced a new scheme to permit app makers and websites to pay for AT&T wireless user bandwidth when those users make use of the app and site services. The AT&T wireless customer who uses a sponsored service, whether it be a streaming, song, show, or other media, will not have the broadband it uses count against their AT&T monthly data allotment. Now, some have characterized the new scheme to be somewhat like a system of toll-free 1-800 numbers for mobile data. In announcing the new scheme, AT&T explained that users will see a sponsored data icon to let them know that a certain application or video is part of their monthly service with a site or app provider. Although AT&T has not disclosed pricing for the program, Wired magazine reported that the first partners to sign up for the sponsored scheme included United Health Group, the Boston advertising startup Acuto and Coney Solutions, and Orlando software makers. We could not begin this new year, of course, without returning in some way to the NSA surveillance revelations that have occupied so much of the news in 2013. One of the biggest new developments came just days after our last episode on December 16th. On Friday, December 20th, President Obama signaled in a press conference that some of the NSA programs detailed in the leaks by Edward Snowden may be reined in. Noting, as reported on Saturday the 21st in the Washington Post, the environment has changed, and just because we can do something doesn't mean that we necessarily should. President Obama also acknowledged that the U.S. needs to provide more confidence to the international community amid widespread outrage over revelations of U.S. spying on foreign allies. The drivers for this shift in policy may have in part been accelerated by several developments in the final days and weeks of 2013. In one element, U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon in Washington ruled that the NSA's dragnet of all U.S. call-related data appears to violate the Constitution's prohibition on unreasonable searches. Judge Leon's ruling said that the NSA had relied on an almost Orwellian technology, unimaginable a generation ago when the U.S. Supreme Court case of U.S. v. Maryland was decided in 1979, a case which addresses basic phone records on which much of the NSA's defense of the programs is based. Judge Leon, an appointee of George W. Bush, has put his ruling on hold to allow the government to construct its appeal, but added that he is not convinced at this point in the litigation that the NSA's database has ever truly served the purpose of rapidly identifying terrorists in time-sensitive investigations. The second element in December was the report of a panel, handpicked by President Obama, and with access to classified files, who were similarly unconvinced that the stockpiling of U.S. data had played any meaningful role in preventing terrorist attacks. Among the panel members were former Deputy CIA Director Michael J. Morell, and former White House counterterrorism advisor Richard A. Clark, both of whom, the Washington Post reported, have spent years immersed in intelligence reports on al-Qaeda. The third element may have been a meeting that President Obama held at the White House on Tuesday, December 17th, at which it was reported that many tech CEOs in attendance voiced consternation with the many going-forward business confidence issues that the NSA activities have placed U.S. tech in, particularly in the international environment. One of the outcomes of the expert panel report was a proposal to perhaps have private companies hold the data that the NSA may want to review, should a case and appropriate guidelines warrant access. But according to the Washington Post, phone companies have voiced that they do not want to be the custodians of this information on behalf of law enforcement or civil attorneys. President Obama's December 20th press conference signaled that a proposal on the surveillance programs will be forthcoming in January. In related news, the FISA court reauthorized the NSA's call data dragnet collection in an order on Friday, January 3rd. Marking a departure from the past secrecy of such orders, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper decided to declassify and disclose publicly that the NSA had sought the order from the FISA court in light of the significant and continuing public interest in the program. That same day, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont had sent a bluntly worded letter asking whether the NSA had spied or is currently spying on members of Congress or other elected officials. When prompted by the Washington Post for an answer for its online column, The Switch, the NSA responded that members of Congress have the same privacy protections as all U.S. persons, but was not able to say no to the senator's questions, although they are crafting a formal reply. And finally, in the first week of January, it was revealed that the NSA is believed to have spent roughly $80 million on development of a quantum computer to better enable encryption hacking and code breaking. Many research groups around the world are pursuing the goal of creating a working quantum computer, so the NSA's interest here is not extraordinary news. But to date, neither other world experts nor the NSA has had great success. Whereas a 1,000-digit encryption key might take a team of current supercomputers a full year to break, a quantum computer would analyze multiple possibilities simultaneously and interconnect the results before moving on to more. The difficulty has been to keep all of these computational elements, called qubits, stable, so that they can interact and be put to useful work. They are very fragile concepts, difficult to build, and the NSA has seemingly had no better luck despite the investment. In the past few weeks, a number of data-related hearings, breaches, and cases in the U.S. have made news. In mid-December, a Senate Commerce Committee report was released following a year-long investigation on data brokerage practices. According to Broadcast and Cable Magazine, the Senate report detailed that in some respects the immense amount of data collected and correlated on U.S. citizens is marketed to potentially exploit the financially vulnerable, with little to no transparency or federal regulation to constrain certain practices. The lack of transparency as to what data is collected and how it's shared is, according to the report, often facilitated by contract language that binds against disclosure of data sources. Among some of the data broker profiles highlighted by Broadcast and Cable included targeting profile categories for ethnic second city strugglers, burned by debt singles, and fragile families. Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Jay Rockefeller highlighted in a December 18th hearing that federal consumer protection laws do not reach many of these actions taken by data brokers, and no right to consumers to know what information is collected, maintained, used, and shared about them, even when such information contains such personal details as physical and mental health, is under U.S. law. However, as highlighted in the Broadcast and Cable piece, the data marketing economic sector has, in the U.S., generated $156 billion in revenue in 2012 alone, and reportedly supports over 475,000 jobs nationwide. Meanwhile, fallout continues over the data breach into retailer Target's customer data in December, with senators calling for a Senate Banking Committee hearing in January to examine whether stronger industry-wide standards are needed. The U.S. retail giant said that up to 70 million of its customers had payment card and personal details stolen from company databases from November 29th and through December 15th. Hackers had been able to place code into Target card swipe machines in order to collect customer information. Although the Target data breach reportedly involved a hack of offline processes and transactions data, across the U.S., legal actions over breaches and company tracking of online activity has seen a marked increase, with more than 200 suits filed in the U.S. simply within the past 18 months, according to the law firm Alston & Byrd. Several key suits involving privacy issues are ongoing in the U.S. District Court in San Jose, California. At issue in some of these cases are privacy policy opt-out buttons, click-to-agree screens, and links to privacy policies. While the need for a clear checkbox on consent is for lawyers a holy grail not only on both U.S. coasts, but also in Asia and Europe, the issue has quickly become whether consumers and their choices far too often fall down the rabbit hole of interminable language as they pull the lever saying, "I agree." This in part treads upon the notion of what is or isn't truly voluntary consent, which is a key determination in the third-party doctrine in the Katz line of case law in the U.S. What is consent? When is it valid? And when does the information that a company discloses as to how it intends to use your information stray too far from the original intent as to strain credulity and require you to go back to the user for another go at expanded consent? These questions were key to lawyers as they began interpreting company requirements that flowed from the Data Protection Directive of 1995 as far back as the early 2000s. But they are front and center again, with some asking whether consent, as we know it, is dead or as a compliance driving tool, should it be dead? The issue prompted Anne Kevoukian, Information and Privacy Commissioner for the Canadian province of Ontario, to write an op-ed with Alexander Dix and Khaled El-Amam, coming to the defense of consent, arguing that value from big data and data analytics will be achieved with privacy embedded directly into the design process. The article, appearing in the online perspectives column of the International Association of Privacy Professionals, underscores many of the common themes to be seen in blogs and comment lists over the past few weeks. On the one side is that technology and innovation, having fueled a kind of innate desire for more and more information, has outridden the human desire for privacy, and in particular, controls where an individual choice must be exercised to give consent. On the other, a feeling that consent of the type expressed in a one-click I agree to a cookie deposit has been and will never be useful for either the user or the provider's lawyer. Contracts of adhesion, terms of the type that used to be printed on the back of a carnival ticket, letting you know that you assume the risk by riding the ride, have long seemed somewhat bizarre in the internet space as applicable to data use. But that consent as an expression of choice and maintenance of control does need to remain but evolve along with transparency and simplicity of terms into a driver of compliance that does not also act as an inhibitor of innovation and service delivery. In the coming week, we will revisit this topic in more detail, but until then, I commend to you the Kevoukian Dix El-Amam op-ed and other materials, including Mr. Eduardo Usteron's book, The Future of Privacy, and Chris Kuhner's recent writings for the Privacy Perspectives column and the Oxford University Press. And speaking of consent, on January 8th, EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding gave a preview of upcoming remarks and, as reported by Bloomberg, has declared that the proposed EU General Data Protection Regulation, stuck in neutral since its October passage from the EU Parliament's ITRA committee, must move full speed ahead. Ms. Reding added that they have lost too much time already and that the European Commission will support the Greek presidency's ambitious objective to reach an agreement on the text by the summer of this year. This direction contrasts with reports in early November that the Commission was beginning to agree with calls from industry in some member states to stay from the Parliament-proposed May vote on the text. Though Committee Rapporteur Jan-Philipp Albrecht agreed heartily with the expected May vote timetable in his remarks late in October in the U.S. before the European Institute. Meanwhile, after more than a dozen hearings on NSA surveillance issues since June, the European Parliament's Libe Committee draft report on surveillance issues has reportedly been leaked. Although the report reportedly recommends suspension of the EU-US safe harbor arrangement, it also reportedly recommends the conclusion of an umbrella agreement between the EU and US to address mechanisms for EU citizen redress in cases of data transfer for law enforcement purposes. As of January 9th, the BBC has reported that the Libe Committee has also voted 36-2 in favor of extending an invitation to Edward Snowden to address the committee by video link. For this purpose, the BBC reports that MEPs are contacting Mr. Snowden's lawyers. The BBC is also reporting that Sky has updated its porn filters, following anger that a legitimate news website was blocked in the midst of Sky's block of an alleged porn site. This news follows the story we reported back in early December, when France was requiring the blocking of 6 sites by search engines and ISPs doing business in France. The story at the time helped to underscore how difficult such blocking can be, particularly when such non-offending sites can often get technically caught up in the blocked set of registrations, or simply because they are also file-sharing sites. The UK government has largely forced several of the country's biggest ISPs to implement new ways of blocking porn, with Sky rolling out its filters in November, according to the BBC, and BT announcing its versions in December. And finally, two decidedly unrelated bits of news, but nonetheless big developments in the US. On January 3rd, President Obama announced 2 new executive actions aimed at boosting federal background checks on guns. The actions come just a few weeks following the first anniversary of the tragic school shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, on December 14th, 2012. And on January 6th, the U.S. Senate confirmed Janet Yellen as the next leader of the Federal Reserve. By a vote of 56-26, on its first day back in session, Ms. Yellen is given the top job, replacing Ben Bernanke when he officially steps down on January 31st. And in another well-regarded decision, Stanley Fischer has been chosen to replace Ms. Yellen as vice chair of the Fed. And that is all we have for you this week. As always, all stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Washington Post, National Public Radio, the BBC, The Gray Sheet, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and Broadcast and Cable Magazine. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. Thank you, as always, for listening. 40A&M and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, January 20th. Remember to pace yourself. It is, after all, only the third week of 2014. But until the 20th, do try to make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.